Support for Yale Cancer Answers is provided by AstraZeneca, a science-led biopharmaceutical company dedicated to elevating conversations about biomarker testing to improve outcomes for advanced cancer patients. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. Welcome to Yale Cancer Answers with Drs. Anish Chagpar, Susan Higgins, and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. Yale Cancer Answers is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care by welcoming oncologists and specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. This week, in honor of Brain Tumor Awareness Month, guest host Dr. Howard Hoxter welcomes Dr. Jennifer Moliterno for a conversation about the treatment and diagnosis of glioblastomas. Dr. Moliterno is an assistant professor of neurosurgery at the Yale School of Medicine, and Dr. Hoxter is the clinical program leader of the gastrointestinal cancers program at Smilo Cancer Hospital.
So, Dr. Moliterno, can you tell us how you got interested in the area of neurosurgery and specifically taking care of brain tumors?
Sure. So first of all, thank you so much for having me this evening. I became interested in neurosurgery very simply. I always wanted to be a surgeon, although when I was a young child, I was afraid of blood, so my parents didn't quite understand that, but nonetheless encouraged me to pursue what I wanted to. And
So you went into the field that had the least blood.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, I wanted to be a heart surgeon, and I ended up, so I overcame my fear of blood, and I ended up not being too impressed with heart surgery, and so
It wasn't brain surgery.
And so when I was studying neuroanatomy, I was fascinated how you could have a lesion in the brain or an abnormality in the brain, and you could predict exactly where it was just based on having a good history and physical exam. And then I spent some time with the neurosurgeons and really was fascinated and enjoyed it. So I put two and two together and became a brain surgeon. And then while I did my residency training here at Yale, I was really drawn to the brain tumor patients. I think that it's a population of patients where you're seeing them at their most vulnerable, and I like to be there for them when they need me the most. And so that's what kind of drew me to that. And in terms of the surgery, it's typically complex and challenging, especially for certain types of brain tumors. And so that solidified my interest. And so then chose to do some fellowship training at Memorial Sloan Kettering.
So you did many years of surgical training and then neurosurgery training and then another fellowship in brain tumor surgery.
So I did 7 years of neurosurgery training and then 1 year of fellowship training at Sloan Kettering.
After 4 years of medical school.
After 4 years of medical school.
Okay.
After 4 years of college.
Right.
Of course.
Okay. Well, we know you are well-trained and very expert in dealing with these things. So what? How do people usually show up when they have primary brain tumors? What usually brings them to medical attention, and how do you usually see them for diagnosis?
So usually people are referred to me oftentimes, most times, after they have already presented to another doctor. And so usually they'll have some sort of issues, whether it's headache or seizure or word-finding difficulties or weakness, depending, of course, on the location of the tumor. And that will prompt them to be seen by their primary care physician or neurologist or eye doctor. Or even times they'll, you know, be in a car accident and it can be incidentally found by chance. But nonetheless, they get to me. And by the time they get to me, of course, they're understandably scared because they have a new diagnosis of a brain tumor. They don't quite understand the diagnosis. And then, of course, they're there to see a brain surgeon. So usually they're not too pleased to see me at first. And I try to change that as best as I can.
Well, that's a tough job, so.
It is.
But I agree that we often see patients and get to bond with them and have really wonderful relationships.
Absolutely.
So, So are brain tumors, primary brain tumors, now very common?
So, you know, if you ask me, they are, of course, because that's what I do day in and day out. But no, largely no. And, you know, the one thing to explain and to caution to people is, you know, everybody has headaches, or everybody will have, you know, some vision trouble here or there and maybe just need glasses. So this is certainly not to scare people. To think that you know, everybody walking around has a brain tumor. So no, in the grand scheme of things, they're definitely relatively uncommon, but nonetheless, they do occur, and we do see quite a few.
And more often, one would tend to see something like either speech problems or weakness on one side, or something that we would call a, quote, focal neurologic finding, compared to, like, personality changes.
Yeah,
or
it really depends. And, you know, when I always say when the tumors occur in location, so if there's a tumor that occurs in a location that we refer to as eloquent brain, which is a high-functioning part of the brain, so an area near speech, an area near motor, which controls strength, an area near nerves that control hearing and balance and things like that. Oftentimes, patients will present earlier with smaller-sized tumors because they will have, as you said, a focal neurological problem. It's when there's tumors that occur more at the skull base or on the surface of the brain or in less dominant parts of the brain that can really grow to larger sizes. And then they can have subtle kind of personality changes or problems with cognition and that sort of thing. And so they can present like that for sure.
Okay. And so then somebody gets a brain CT scan and it shows an abnormal density,
right,
a mass there.
Correct.
But you can't necessarily tell if it's benign or malignant based on that.
Well, so oftentimes somebody, as you said, will get a CT scan. And then really the better test for understanding brain tumors is an MRI. And so again, by the time they see me, they've already had the MRI. And usually that's done with contrast, which can, you know, help see whether or not there's any uptake of dye. And again, you know, doing this day in and day out, we're fairly good at being able to have an understanding based on the characteristics if the tumor is benign or malignant, being more cancerous. And so I always tell my patients that I like to be wrong and I hope to be wrong, but I, especially if I think that it's a malignant tumor, but I usually have a pretty good idea based on just the MRI imaging alone. But we don't know 100% until we actually have a piece of tissue, if we need the piece of tissue.
Okay. And these, even the primary brain tumors, the so-called glioma-type brain tumors, there are different categories in there. So
there are.
That depends more on what the pathologist sees?
Correct. And so, and nowadays, molecular testing as well. And so there's four grades to brain tumors. We don't stage them like, you know, cancers of the bodies do. It's just grading. And so grades 1 through 4 of gliomas, 4 being the most malignant, most aggressive, also known as glioblastoma. Grade 2, we refer to more as lower grade tumors. And so these have a more benign clinical course. And what the pathologist sees usually, you know, is more benign as well. But there's always the risk there for transformation of tumors becoming higher grades, such as the grade 3, which is anaplastic, and of course grade 4 GBM. And so that's why we still treat those very aggressively. In terms of diagnosis and treatment.
And so what is the treatment approach today for these kind of tumors?
So our treatment approach here at Yale really is to be as aggressive as we can in terms of removing as much tumor as possible, but being as safe as possible and making sure that we maintain the patient's function, which of course is the goal of any surgery. And so oftentimes we'll, again, see a patient after they've been diagnosed with an MRI, have a feeling as to what the tumor is likely, And then if it is amenable to surgery, if we do think that it should be removed, again, some tumors are found by chance, and if they're benign, we can usually follow them. But for the ones that we're concerned about or the patient is symptomatic, et cetera, then we try to remove as much of the tumor as possible. And we have certainly the resources and capabilities here to do that, as removing as much tumor as possible has been shown to be beneficial in terms of outcome.
So the first thing will be like kind of this aggressive surgery, but still maintaining
absolutely
the neurologic function is
absolutely
the best degree possible.
Absolutely. And so oftentimes we do get referrals where patients have been told they have inoperable brain tumors, for instance. And, you know, we see them and evaluate them. And a lot of times, we can do certain things during surgery that makes the surgery safer, that allows the tumors to become more operable. For instance, we have really sophisticated neuromonitoring techniques, and so we're able to monitor motor function, even speech if necessary, with awake craniotomy. Again, not always, but when necessary. That allows me as the surgeon to remove as much tumor as possible, but be reassured that the patient's function is being maintained. So that allows me to really push the surgery as much as I can. Likewise, at Yale, we also use intraoperative ultrasound, as well as neuronavigation, which is like a GPS system for the brain. Which also helps in terms of as much tumor as we can remove. And then, of course, we are the only center in the state that has an intraoperative MRI. And so the beauty of that is I can remove tumor. And, you know, as a brain tumor surgeon, I'm pretty good at telling the difference between tumor and what's brain. Sometimes it gets tricky, even with the microscope. And so we can get a quick MRI with the patient asleep on the table, and it's the same quality as an MRI that's done in the outpatient setting. And so I can then go back and remove whatever tumor remains that I might have missed.
So they have a big magnet right in the OR that they put the guy's head in.
Exactly. So so there's two rooms in the operating room, and in between is a big magnet, is a big MRI. And it's on tracks on the ceiling, and it goes back and forth between the two rooms. And one of the rooms also is what we refer to as a hybrid operating room. It's the only one, I believe, in New England, the last I knew, that has angiogram capabilities. And so that also allows us, or I should say it allows my endovascular or vascular colleagues, to do an angiogram at the time of surgery as well, which certainly can make certain brain tumor surgeries, especially ones that are particularly bloody. It can help decrease the bleeding. And it also makes aneurysm surgery and other types of surgery like that safer and more effective.
You work with the radiologist on that?
Actually, it's a neurosurgeon. Yeah, it's an interventional trained neurosurgeon.
Yeah. Pretty cool. And so with this magnet thing, like, do you put people through a metal detector before they come in? Because want stuff flying around.
Everybody knows you have to watch a video before going into the MRI rooms, and you have to go through certain training. I haven't done it in years, obviously, so I don't remember exactly.
Tell.
Yeah, no, but I'm cleared. and so absolutely. And so, but of course, the instruments that we use are all metal. So they have to just be certain, you know, at a certain spot away from the field. So when it's time for the MRI after I remove the tumor, we'll then count all the instruments, all the needles, everything that's metal.
No, I kind of assumed you use non-magnetic metal. But
No. The head frame that we put the patient in is non-magnetic, so there's a special one. But all the other equipment, not the anesthesia equipment, that's not metal either, but the surgical instruments all have to be put away and counted. And so it's really quite an operation in the sense that There's many people who make these surgeries happen and just happen so effortlessly. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, that's exciting. Thank you. So we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about glioblastomas with Dr. Jennifer Moliterno.
Support for Yale Cancer Answers is provided by AstraZeneca, working to pioneer targeted lung cancer treatments and advance knowledge of diagnostic testing. More information at AstraZeneca-US.com. It is estimated that over 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, with almost 3,000 new cases in Connecticut alone. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from the disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, and at Smilow Cancer Hospital to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Artemis machine is a new technology being used at Smilow Cancer Hospital that enables targeted biopsies to be performed as opposed to removing multiple cores from the prostate for examination that may not be necessary. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
This is Dr. Howard Hoxter, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Jennifer Moliterno, and we're discussing the surgical care of glioblastomas, high-grade or malignant brain tumors. So that sounds very fascinating about everything you do to try to get out every last malignant cell when you're operating on patients who have these high-grade brain tumors. So what are some of the other treatments that after you've done the best surgery that's possible?
So as I always tell my patients with glioblastoma in particular, and even lower-grade gliomas, we're usually able to get as much of the contrast-enhanced portion or the portion of the tumor that takes up dye as much as we can. But these tumors tend to be infiltrative, and so there's usually microscopic spread of tumors that are beyond what we're able to see, even in the best of circumstances, anybody can see in the operating room. And so it's very important that patients undergo chemotherapy and radiation following surgery. Of course, it's helpful to remove as much of that tumor as possible, as it makes the success of the chemotherapy and the radiation that much better.
And so you work with a multidisciplinary team.
Correct. And so after surgery, usually the surgeries are tolerated remarkably well, as most people are usually surprised, but most tend to spend a night or so in the ICU, a couple of days in the hospital, and go home. Of course, more complicated tumors and such may require a little bit more rehabilitation. But following that, we will present the patient, even after he or she leaves the hospital, we'll present at our multidisciplinary tumor board, where other doctors who are just solely dedicated to treating brain tumors, neuro-oncologists, neuroradiologists, radiation oncologists, neuropathologists, et cetera, will review each person and will come up with a plan. And that usually will involve, especially for glioblastoma, radiation and chemotherapy. Again, it's a very standardized protocol. The chemotherapy that's recommended, which is given by the neuro-oncologist, is an oral chemotherapy, and it's usually tolerated pretty well by patients. Of course, then there's options for clinical trials and such, and being at an academic center with, again, this multidisciplinary type care makes those options more available.
So what do you feel the advantages are of when you have these tumor boards, when you sit down with all these specialists, including neuropathologists who spend all their day
Absolutely.
Trying to
yeah.
classify the tumors. That's one of the, I think, key things in deciding the grade and therefore the prognosis.
Absolutely. And so I personally wouldn't work in any other type of environment. And if it was my loved one, I would be sure to find a place, and usually it's an academic place, such as Yale, that has such collaborative efforts amongst different subspecialists. These are people who, including myself, just dedicate our lives to treating people specifically with brain tumors. And so that's certainly an advantage for the patient, and it makes a real difference in terms of outcome. And I really couldn't do my job without the other people I work with.
And, I mean, what if you can take out the whole brain tumor? Why do people need these additional therapies?
So you can't take the whole thing out. As I mentioned, you can take out a large part of, if not even all of, the part of the tumor that takes up dye. However, with gliomas in particular, they usually have cells that are spreading throughout the brain. And that extends beyond the area of the tumor that is taking up dye. And so I always say, no matter how good I am, no matter how good the surgery goes, there's always a role for chemotherapy and radiation with these tumors. And it's because I, nor anyone, can remove every piece of the tumor, unfortunately. I wish that I could.
So there are some kind of microscopic cells that are infiltrating through the brain tissue itself.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what the medications and the radiation really targets. And so my job is still an important one, because I decrease the tumor burden for sure. And the more I can decrease the tumor burden, the less tumor there is for the chemotherapy and the radiation to work on.
And people usually recover pretty quickly after surgery.
Absolutely, like this. Yeah. So again, you know, we tend to be referred patients with more complex and complicated type tumors, and so there are certainly exceptions that patients can have longer recovery periods, especially if they have a more complicated type of a tumor. But by and large, for the most part, the vast majority of our patients, again, have a very, tolerate it very well, have a very short hospital stay and go home, able to take care of themselves. I always say, you know, they come back to clinic around 10 days, 14 days after surgery, and most of the time I can't even find the incision, you know, to remove the stitches and such, because hair has grown back. We only shave a small piece of hair. And so people do remarkably well.
That's really great to hear.
It is.
And then the course of this kind of postoperative treatment with the radiation and mm-hmm. the chemotherapy, how long does that go on for?
So we usually will wait about 2 weeks or so before we allow the radiation doctors and the oncology doctors to start their treatment. We just want to be sure that the wound has healed and that sort of thing. And then after that, the radiation is, again, pretty standardized, so about 6 weeks of treatment usually. And then they'll cycle that with the oral chemotherapy.
And how long does that go on for?
It usually goes on a regimen where they'll kind of come on and come off, and the neuro-oncologist manages that.
Okay. So what is on the horizon that excites you for treatment of these malignant brain tumors in the near future?
In terms of surgery, you know, what excites me is the technology that allows us to push the surgery further. And so for me, that's, again, things like the intraoperative MRI, that's techniques in terms of neuromonitoring, that's performing awake craniotomies, again, when we need to monitor language, which is not in every patient, but refining those things that make the surgery as successful as possible. In terms of trials, there's, that's always on the horizon, clinical trials, in terms of what we can do to better target the disease. As, again, it's largely not a surgical disease. There's limitations with what the surgery can do, even in the best of circumstances. So there's some trials where we can actually inject, for instance, viruses into the brain at the time of surgery. We were involved with a multi-center trial with that, which then allows a pretty benign and well-tolerated drug that the patient will take, and it converts it actually to a chemotherapy. So it allows the patient to have less side effects, but of course the effects of the chemotherapy.
So you infect the tumor cells, and then mm-hmm. you take a pill to turn it on and kill them.
Yeah, and so I basically remove the tumor and then inject the virus into the resection cavity, and then that has an enzyme that converts the well-tolerated drug into the not-so-tolerated chemotherapy there.
And that's pretty. The viruses go specifically to tumor cells,
correct.
And not the normal brain.
Correct. And then other, also kind of along the lines of surgery, every single brain tumor that we remove, or even biopsy here at Yale, we send to our tumor bank and to our tumor labs. And so not only do we, as you were saying, the importance of diagnosing the tumors properly, but we also look at the genetic makeup of every tumor. And so every tumor here is sequenced. And so we understand the mutation profile of all the tumors. And I think that will play a large role in the future in better targeting these tumors. Glioblastoma, for instance, has many, many, many mutations. And so it's incredibly heterogeneous. And I think that's why chemotherapies have trouble with treating the tumor. So the idea behind it, and of course, we refer to it as precision medicine, is to more precisely target the mutations in the tumors with drugs that are
there are
more appropriate.
Many of them have these IDH mutations.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that we usually talk about in terms of the lower grade tumors, but those are definitely important. And so that's one thing we check for in terms of our markers, and that helps with prognosis, but it also helps in terms of our decision making, again, at the tumor board.
Mm-hmm. And the role of immunotherapy now in these gliomas? How's that going?
That's another very promising avenue. Of course, taking a page from melanoma and from lung cancers and such, and applying it to brain tumors has been incredibly important. And so we have some of those trials here at Yale, and the results have been quite promising. And so that, as well as small molecule inhibitors, for instance, I think that's where, again, as much as I like to think that a lot has to do with what I do, and it does to an extent, it's really the medical treatment, I think, that is going to allow us to figure a way to cure this thing.
But clearly what you do in terms of surgery and kind of reducing it to the minimum
Absolutely.
Amount is really critical in helping people live
Absolutely.
The best for the longest
yeah.
time.
And not to mention that, oftentimes these tumors, especially when they're larger, they'll have, they can cause headaches for patients. They can cause swelling in the brain. They can cause problems too. And so oftentimes I'll take patients to surgery, and they really do improve after surgery because that mass is gone. And so I think there will always be a role for surgery, and certainly for more aggressive surgery that's safe. And that's the key, is making it as safe as possible.
So it sounds like we have a lot of technology that's in play here and a lot of expertise where people really work solely on brain tumors at the Yale Cancer Center.
Mm-hmm.
this is a little different than people find in many places.
Yeah, I think it's certainly, you know, what you find at places like Yale, at Memorial, where I was, where you would expect. But I think when we're talking in terms of brain tumors, I think it's important to be at an academic center, such as the ones that I mentioned. I think people are sometimes reluctant when they hear academic because they think, you know, I don't want to be a guinea pig, and yeah, I don't want to, you know, have people practicing on me, or, you know, whatever the myths are. But they're simply not true. What it means is that there's a lot of people collaborating to make it the best care possible.
And so what's your advice to people when they, you know, unfortunately may find out that they have a brain tumor?
My advice is, seek care at an academic institution such as Yale. We're always happy to see patients, always willing to see patients, and always consider getting a second opinion. Make sure that the surgeon you're seeing is somebody who is a brain tumor surgeon, not just a neurosurgeon who also does other types of surgery. You really want an expert. You really want somebody who's specialized. And again, always seek a second opinion. It doesn't hurt.
Dr. Jennifer Moliterno is an assistant professor of neurosurgery at the Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions, the address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and past editions of the program are available in audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in each week to learn more about the fight against cancer here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.